History is a pack of lies about events that never happened, told by people who weren't there. This week's opening quote comes from George Santayana. Welcome to Surviving the Matrix, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Maxwell Egan. It's a pleasure to be with you once again, and I will be your host for the next hour. And right here at the start of the show, folks, I'd like to put out my absolute heartfelt sympathies and send what healing energy I can to the enormous fires that are raging in the Amazon jungle right now. Very, very sad situation we're seeing unfold in the Amazon, folks. Something like 2 million square miles of forest being burned. Absolutely shocking. Incredible loss of life, an incredible loss of medicines, just an incredible loss. And no coincidence either. This fire is most definitely not a natural occurrence. This fire has been deliberately lit, most likely by mining companies. But anyway, I'll leave that there. I just wanted to put out that message and send what energy I can to the Amazon jungle and to those lives that are threatened by this fire. Not just human lives, but all lives. The jungle is a very special place. Another thing, folks, I did an interview the other day that I called the externalization of the hierarchy. During that interview, I was using the word Jayish to talk about the man with small hats. The producer who jumped into the show actually thought that that was self-censorship and we shouldn't use that. We should say the full word. I warned him not to, but he did use the full word, and so the auto-caption that they used for censorship was able to detect what we were talking about, and so that video has now been deleted for hate speech, and my channel has had a strike put against it, and I can no longer upload to that channel. It's now been penalized for, I'm not sure how long, they haven't told me, there's no message there to let me know how long the strike will be in place, but I can no longer upload to my Crow House video channel, so I will be uploading this week's show to my old AOD Scarecrow channel. So yeah, my apologies for that, folks, but that is my backup channel, the old channel, AOD Scarecrow. If you haven't subscribed to it yet, I do suggest you do, and I will see if I can also upload this video to BitChute as well. But yeah, just to let you know, that's the current situation of the Crow House on YouTube. And of course, if you are attempting to watch the show on BitChute, you may find that you can't access the BitChute website. You may have to use a VPN. This is certainly the case if you live in Australia and have a Telstra connection, or I think an Optus connection as well. There are some connections that will still get through, but the main telcos have blocked BitChute at the ISP level, so you can't access it. You need to get a VPN in order to access this website. And that is the same for some other countries as well, not just Australia. So do get a VPN so you can access BitChute, or just get the Opera browser and use Opera to access BitChute, because I believe the Opera browser has an inbuilt VPN. So if you can't afford to get a VPN, you can just use Opera, and that's a workaround for that as well. So yeah, just to keep you informed, folks, of what is going on with the online status of the Crow House, which seems to be getting shakier by the day. Beginning on with things, what I wanted to actually talk about this week was history. You know, a year or so ago, probably a year ago now, I started bringing you some shows on history. The fact that our history has very likely been fabricated, and this again is something that I started with way back in 2005 when I wrote that book that I've got on my website, Earth's Forbidden Secrets. I was kind of pointing out to people then that history has been fabricated. It simply isn't what we've been told. And there's been some very, very interesting things uncovered in the last couple of years. A lot of people have been looking into this. The revelation of the once great civilization of Tartaria and possibly other civilizations that came before that has been a huge red pill for a lot of people, and a lot of people have really gotten on board with it. Now, evidence of what we're calling the mud flood has been found all over the world. It's been found across Europe, it's been found across England, in the United States, it's even been found here in Australia. The only thing that's really been a question of it is when did it happen? Some people have suggested it happened in the 1600s, and some people have suggested that it occurred in the 1800s. But there is, of course, a possibility that it occurred twice, possibly both in the 1600s and the 1800s. So that's something else that I'll touch on a little bit later in the show. Something else we've identified is the existence of a worldwide root language, which was Magyar. The work of Attila Flink showed that this language was prevalent here in Australia. It was also spoken by the tribes in the Melanesian and Polynesian areas and by the Incas. There's also talk of a Hungarian man who was able to understand the Aboriginal languages in northern Canada as well, and another one in northern Russia. So this shows that this language, Magyar, essentially the root language of Hungarian, was very likely the worldwide root language that existed before the previous cataclysm, either the one in the 1800s or the one in the 1600s, or perhaps even before that time. Like I said, we don't really know how many of these events have occurred. And that's one of the big problems with looking at all this stuff, is we can only really trace it back so far because the history is so convoluted. I mean, it's convoluted anyway. But once we get back to pre-1600s, we really don't know what we're dealing with, simply because so much of it has been fabricated and so much has been moved around. Places have been moved around. Histories have been moved around. Things have been changed. I've pointed out to you before, you can find a lot of Syrian history actually recounted in British myth. And you can find things such as the tales of Ulysses, where he names the island of England as Syria. So that's very interesting as well. There's even talk, people will tell you, that the real Jerusalem can be found somewhere in Russia. We don't know how true any of this stuff is, but the point is that things have been changed. And, you know, once they start moving history around and attributing different folk tales and different historical narratives to different countries, then it becomes very, very difficult over a couple of generations to find out what the truth is and which areas of land these stories actually relate to. But one of the most interesting things that we find is how the maps have changed over the years. You know, maps that show lands that are no longer there, maps that depict land at the North Pole, maps that show the island of Friesland being quite a large island with many major cities and villages and mountain ranges and rivers and local smaller islands and all sorts of stuff that was apparently located just southwest of Iceland. This is depicted on many, many maps. That is now gone. An interesting thing about that as well is that there is now a section of Holland that is called Friesland. Obviously not the same place, but it does bear the same name. As I've mentioned before, we have maps that depict California as an island. We have maps that show quite a large inland lake called Lake Conibus, which you can see depicted on maps in southwestern North America. A lake that was no longer there. And as pointed out by a friend of mine who's actually living in Copenhagen at the moment, there is a similar situation where there was a lake that is depicted in South America, which is no longer there as well. This, I believe, was called Lake Zaire. An interesting thing is that early maps of North America do not show the Great Lakes as well. And very interestingly, they depict Chicago, which is actually on the shores of the Great Lakes, but they don't show the Great Lakes. It's like the lakes weren't there. Chicago was there, but the lake that it sits on the edge of was not depicted on the map. And the maps are quite detailed. Why would a cartographer not include something as large as the largest lake system in the world if he were making a map? I mean, you know, you think he would notice this sort of body of water sitting there. So why isn't it depicted on the early maps? It's not on maps around the 1500s. It's not until the mid-1600s that we actually find the Great Lakes depicted on maps of North America. And it would appear that prior to that time, they simply weren't there. Interesting. As I said, this has been pointed out to me by a friend of mine. He's an American guy who's living in Copenhagen at the moment. His name is Steve Falconer, and he's put out a few videos on this topic, which are actually quite outstanding videos. He's really done some good dot connecting. And if you're watching this on YouTube, I'll be sure to put a link to his videos or his channel below in the description of this video. What he's done is he's looked at the reports of strange events and cataclysms and things that have been recorded in books from the 1600s and 1800s, and something remarkable that he's found right through the mid-1600s is the incredible amount of reports of comet activity in the sky at that time. We can, of course, question whether these were actual comets that people were reporting or whether it was simply plasma activity or meteor showers or whatever. But it's quite remarkable to see the amount of comets that were reported, the amount of activity that was happening in the sky, and to see the amount of Earth changes that we see depicted on maps at that time as well. And the same can be said for around the 1800s. We see all sorts of reports of strange occurrences, such as large earthquakes that rocked five states of the United States in the mid-1800s, around 1812. And many people will remember the date 1816, which was recorded as 1800 and frozen to death, many places around the world. So there appears to have been some sort of worldwide catastrophe that happened both in the 1600s and in the 1800s. And all of this can also be related and ties into grand solar minimums that happened at that time as well. An interesting thing is that we are heading for another grand solar minimum now, which is beginning to start now and is set to be in full swing by 2040-2050. And if history has taught us anything, it is that these grand solar minimums are times of extreme upheaval on the Earth. Well, that certainly seems to be the case if the maps that we have available to us and the records from the time are anything to go by anyway. And you'll find that records from both these times also depict a large amount of activity in the sky. Some may attribute this to being UFO activity. This is what a lot of researchers like to call it. It could be UFO activity, or it could simply be plasma events and whatever. But we know that there are a lot of reports of strange lights in the sky and all sorts of strange occurrences in the mid-1600s and in the early to mid-1800s. So it's very interesting as well. Just a coincidence, of course, if you believe in such things. Now, something else that I've discussed with you previously is the existence of the orphan trains, the enormous amount of children who were being trafficked not only around Europe but also around the entire world around circa 1880 in the latter half of the 19th century. Around 635,000 children trafficked across Europe, 200,000 children per annum sent from east to west across the United States, 100,000 children sent out to Australia, sent out to New Zealand, sent out to Africa. And the distinct possibility that these children were sent out to clean up after the mud flood, after whatever had happened, the cataclysm, whatever it was that caused this great destruction across the earth, these children were sent out to clean up and to repopulate the world. An interesting thing as well, when you look at some of the convict prisons here in Australia, such as the Port Arthur prison, you notice the cells are extremely small. So you've got to wonder who the convicts were, the so-called convicts who were sent out here. Was it really convicts, or was it actually children that were sent out and kept in these enclosures and then put to work during the daytime? When these children would have grown up and had children of their own, then of course these children could have been taught any history you wanted to teach them. The original children that arrived in these places wouldn't even have been interested in history because they would have been too concerned with day-to-day survival in the conditions they would have been forced to endure to even have any concern about history at all. They'd be too young to even be worrying about it. They wouldn't be concerned with how they got there. They'd simply be concerned with getting through each day. So it's another really interesting point to consider. But there is every indication that many of these places were actually civilized, and what we were seeing wasn't really a colonization of new lands, it was a cleanup after the devastation that occurred to the previous civilization that existed in all of these places. And again, this appears to have been a worldwide culture, a worldwide civilization. They were calling Tartaria for want of a better name. I mean, Tartaria is certainly the name of the place, the civilization, the culture that existed in Europe, And it certainly seems to have been connected to North America, South America, the Philippines and Australia and other places as well, possibly even Japan. But we don't know if Tartaria was the entire civilization. It's simply the biggest area and it's one word that we have to go on. So we need to be a little bit clear in what we're presenting here. But the fact of the matter is that there is every indication there was a previous civilization, a very advanced civilization that once existed on this earth. And there is every indication that this previous civilization was destroyed by some type of cataclysm. And there are many people that are calling this a reset and saying that what we're seeing here is a deliberate reset of civilization. Now, the concept that civilization occurs cyclically, these events occur cyclically, and that civilization is brought to a certain point, mankind is culled, and then they start again. And this is a man-made thing, a deliberate event that happens every couple hundred years or so. This is what many people are saying, but the fact of the matter is that we don't know. We don't know whether it's a deliberate event or whether it is a cosmic event, a galactic event, some sort of a part of the Earth's cycle that happens completely independently of us, or whether there is some sort of technology that actually brings these situations about. You know, there is a possibility that these things are naturally occurring cycles that people knew about, which would explain why we have such an incredible amount of underground cities, such as the recent city that was found in Turkey that I've touched on some previous shows as well, like huge underground cities, multi-story underground cities, all carved out of the stone. These people were definitely not wanting to live on the surface of the earth because they were aware of events that happened, which would place them in danger. I mean, it's a very interesting when you look at the lay of the oceans as well. You look at the lay of the continental shelf off the coast of America, the east coast and the west coast of America. It's very interesting because what you see in the deep ocean areas are trenches that are carved out of the areas. And when you really look at the shelf, the only way these trenches could be there was if vast amounts of water poured off the top of the continental shelf and poured down into the deep areas where the deep ocean is and caused these trenches to be burrowed out by the flowing water. But the problem is that if that were to occur, the only way it could occur was if there was no water in the areas of deep ocean where these what look like rivers have been carved out. And when you look at them, folks, these are watercourses. These have been carved out by flowing water. These aren't cracks that have been created from seismic activity or anything like that. These are the results of flowing water. So what would have caused that? This would indicate that the oceans were moved. You know, the oceans perhaps flowed across the continents, but at one point that area of deep ocean did not have any water there because that's the only way these trenches could have been carved. And if the oceans did flow across the continents, perhaps something like a crustal shift or whatever the cause is, I mean, we don't know what would cause it, but whatever would cause this, if the oceans were simply to flow across the continents, when they poured off the continental shelf on the other side, you would see exactly this type of result, and you would also see what we would term a mud flood, would be the result of this. From the enormous tidal waves that went across the continents, they would, of course, leave a lot of silt and residue behind, which would very likely half bury, if not completely bury, the civilizations that were there. So it could be possible that's why these underground cities exist, why these places that are so well built and so well protected all exist beneath the earth, because again, the people who lived there were very aware of events that were going to happen on the surface of the earth, which could include something like the oceans changing location, or it could even include other things which could well be plasma events which cause the ground to liquefy, and we see such things as the mud flood happening. I mean, this is speculative, but it's a very real possibility that this is why all these underground places exist. And there are quite a lot of underground places, folks. It isn't just one in Turkey. There's a whole bunch of underground structures that we found all over the earth, and we all know about the deep underground bases that this culture, this civilization we're in now has built, you know, the deep underground military bases. What are they for and who really built them? Were they really built by our culture or were they built by pre-existing cultures? You know, are these events cyclic and are they something that we have no control over? But there is, even with saying that, there is every indication that even if these events are something that we don't have any control over, there are still instances where deliberate attempts at depopulating the survivors have been undertaken. You know, when you look at things such as the Great Plague, the Black Death that went across Europe a few hundred years ago, there's some very, very strange reports that come out about this as well. And a lot of what we're hearing about the Black Death and the Black Plague may not actually be what we're told. You know, bubonic plague, we're told, came from rats. Well, from the fleas that infected the rats, the fleas that lived on the rats, it was the fleas that spread the plague to the people. But was that really the case? Because there is every indication that things may have been otherwise. Actually, I want to share a letter that was written to me by a listener who shared some really interesting insights from a book by William Bramley called The Gods of Eden. And what he sent me was an excerpt from chapter 18, pages 180 and 181. I'd like to share that with you now, and I'll just read this passage that he sent me regarding the Black Plague in Europe, and see what you think about this. And I quote, "We would normally shake our heads at this tragic period of human history and be thankful that modern medicine has developed cures for these dread diseases. However, troubling enigmas about the Black Death still linger. Many outbreaks occurred in summer during warm weather in uncorked regions. Not all outbreaks of bubonic plague were preceded by rodent infestation. In fact, only a minority of cases seem to be related to an increase in the presence of vermin. The greatest puzzle about the Black Death is how it was able to strike isolated human populations which had no contact with earlier infected areas. The epidemics also tended to end abruptly. To solve these puzzles, a historian would normally look to records from the plague years to see what the people were reporting. But when he does, he encounters stories so stunning and unbelievable that he is likely to reject them as fantasies and superstitions of badly frightened minds. A great many people throughout Europe and other plague-stricken regions of the world were reporting that outbreaks of the plague were caused by foul-smelling mists. Those mists frequently appeared after unusual bright lights in the sky. The historian quickly discovers that the mists and bright lights were reported far more frequently and in many more locations than were rodent infestations. The plague years were, in fact, a period of heavy UFO activity. The epidemic first spread through Europe between 1347 and 1350. The bubonic plague continued to strike Europe with decreasing fatality every 10 to 20 years in short-lived outbreaks all the way up to the 1700s. Although it is difficult to calculate the total number of deaths from that 400-year period, it is believed that 100 million people may have died from the plague." And end quote. Now, isn't that an interesting excerpt from that book, ladies and gentlemen? The concept that the plague was caused by foul-smelling mists accompanied by unusually bright lights in the sky, and that the reports of these mists and bright lights were far more frequent and in many more locations than were the reports of rodent infestation. You know, when you look at what we know these days about biological warfare, you've really got to look at this and really start questioning what really happened with that. You know, and with the concept of there being these periodic cataclysms that happened, if you were someone who was well set up underground and you knew all about this and you knew that these resets happened, whether they're man-made or not, and you were the one who was organizing the theft of so many children who go missing so you could repopulate the world after the next cataclysm and teach them whatever history you want, would you not also want to clean up whatever pockets of population were left on the surface and perhaps get rid of them so that the history would become even more convoluted and even more decimated? I mean, obviously you're going to want the least amount of people that you can get away with left, because you're not going to want anyone to be able to continue the oral traditions of the true story. You're not going to want the truth to come down to subsequent generations, not if you intend to run the whole show again anyway. And that's certainly something to think about. But when you hear those reports, I mean, it really does appear that this was some sort of a biological agent that was being deliberately inflicted upon the people back in the 1300s and way up until the 1700s as well. You know, as I've often said, ladies and gentlemen, all the world is a stage, and there is so much going on this earth that we are unaware of. And even when we attempt to find the truth, it's very difficult to find because all of the information we've got has been constructed and falsified and put there to lead us generally in the wrong direction. Now, it's not until you're prepared to start thinking right outside the box that you can begin to see a little of what's actually going on here. And that's why it's so important not to get stuck into belief systems along the way as well. I mean, consider everything, but believe nothing, because once you adopt a belief system, then all the information that comes to you is going to be judged in accordance with that belief system. And stuff that doesn't fit in with your belief system, you may disregard and you may discard. And it may well be important information which will one day lead us to the truth. So all things have to be considered. But I find all of this sort of stuff fascinating. You know, really, when you just look at what the maps say and you look at what the reports from the time say, and you look at what the evidence that is lying all over the world says on its own. I mean, the stone monuments that are left as relics of this past civilization really do speak volumes. They speak in a very, very loud voice if people just have the right type of ears to hear and the right type of eyes to see what they're actually looking at. You know, you do this and you approach it from the right angle and approach it with a very open mind, and the picture begins to paint itself and the truth begins to rear its head and show itself to you. It's just, as I said, it depends on how far you're prepared to think outside of the box, because there's a lot more going on here than what people would ever consider to be true. But the fact of the matter is that when you really start looking at this stuff, you begin to see that many of the old stories of myths and legends and stuff that we would deem to be fantasy may not be quite as fantastic as we think and may actually have its basis in reality and in some very real history that has been very well hidden from us. But I think we have reached break time there, folks. I'll leave it there for now, and we'll come back to this after the break. Thank you for joining me on the air today. It's always a pleasure to have your company. And I'll be back to speak to you again in a few minutes. Thanks for listening, and don't go away because there's plenty more to discuss. And welcome back to the show, ladies and gentlemen. So one of the most difficult things in attempting to bring any of this type of information to people is that real truth can never be told. Real truth must be realized. Most people have belief systems that get in the way. If you try to tell people the truth, they simply won't believe you. You know, and as I've said many times, you know, the truth seems to be pretty subjective depending on what people want to believe. If you want to look at it that way, you know, when you look at it in regard to the truth movement, anyway, the truth movement in inverted commas, which I believe shouldn't really have even been named the truth movement. It should more be a freedom movement, because that's what all this is about. That's what this has always been about, is establishing the freedom we need to discover what the truth is. Because until that time, you can believe anything you want to believe. It doesn't make any of it true, because all the information has been put there to lead us down whatever rabbit hole resonates with you. And that's really what it comes down to, folks. It's what resonates with you. It's not what's true at all. It's what you choose to believe. And that's the situation that we're up against, because, you know, the real truth, what is the real truth? There must be some real ultimate truth, but nobody knows what it is. And until people are prepared to admit that, we're never going to get anywhere. Until people are prepared to put their beliefs down and just look at things and let the path unfold before you as it will without choosing to believe anything, then we're never going to get anywhere. You know, once people are prepared to do that and prepared to respect the people around them, then we may actually begin to make some sort of a difference. You know, because the lack of respect for people around us, the lack of respect for people who think differently to anybody with a belief system is one of the things that is used to keep us so under control. This has been the big obstacle that the so-called truth movement, the resistance, the freedom movement, whatever we can call it, has faced since day one, is that people will go down rabbit holes, they'll adopt belief systems, and then they'll think that anybody who doesn't support their belief system is the enemy. This is one of the biggest tools that has been used against us, and it has become so prevalent in the resistance over the last 4 or 5 years, and it is simply the biggest obstacle we face to ever establishing freedom. There's just too many belief systems getting in the way, and really, we've got to put it all down, because we're never going to find out what the truth is until we're prepared to look at everybody and look at everything and consider everything, but believe nothing. Now, the problem is, when even doing this type of research, is that too many people find stuff that resonates with them. It appeals to their romantic sense of adventure, and then they adopt the belief system and they jump into their own self-constructed box. You know, many people who claim to be thinking outside the box may well be thinking outside the mainstream box, but unfortunately, all they're doing is thinking inside a new box that they've constructed for themselves simply due to adopting a belief system as soon as they found some information that resonated with them. And this is a huge problem. It's a huge problem to ever getting to the bottom of anything. And it only ever serves to create an enormous amount of division with other people who have constructed different boxes for themselves based on their own belief systems. And it all depends on what information people have looked at and what has resonated with them and what they've made of that information. And they may have not had access to the same information as other people because so much has been put out there. And even when people find information that resonates with them, they'll write their own articles about that information and they'll put out there, and all they do is really offer their own opinion on something they have looked at from a perspective of a belief system, and they have succeeded in further muddying the waters. This is what happens with so many of the books we read. You know, many books we read are simply people offering you their opinion on another book that somebody else has written, which is very often that person simply offering you their opinion on a previous book that someone else has written. So we never really get anywhere. We never get to the original source of the idea. All we get is interference with the original idea due to people's belief systems that are imposed upon it along the way before it gets to us. Then we get it and we impose our own interpretation, our own belief system on it, and then we force it upon somebody else. And like I said, folks, all we do when we do this is further muddy the waters. As once said by Mark Twain, most people's beliefs and convictions are, in almost every case, gotten at second hand and without examination from authorities who have not themselves examined the question at issue, but have taken them second hand from other non-examiners whose opinions about them were not worth a brass farthing to begin with. And that's a great quote, and that's kind of what we're facing when we're looking at information down these rabbit holes that we're given, attempting to find the truth of anything. That's the thing, you know, and even with people researching history, attempting to find out what the true origins of whatever race you're looking into, the white race, the black race, the Chinese race, whatever race people are looking into, even the true origins of the civilization touch area that we're trying to find information about, any of these things, we've got to understand that most of the history books we're looking at have been falsified. Most of the timelines are wrong. So, you know, where do you start? Where do you even begin to find the true information that's going to give us a factual story? Is it anywhere out in the mainstream? Are we going to find it anywhere that isn't locked into a Vatican vault or something? I mean, that's the question, folks. How difficult is it to find the real information? And we've got to be careful of just running into stuff that resonates with us and thinking it's the truth simply because we go, yeah, this resonates with me. Because essentially what you're saying when you say that is, well, this information makes me feel comfortable. But the question is it actually truthful information, or has it been put there simply because the people who put it there knew it would make you feel comfortable? You've really got to use a certain amount of discernment when looking at all of this stuff, folks. You really do. It really is a mess out there, folks, so you've really got to be careful what you choose to believe along the way and how you choose to interpret other people's words and what belief you choose to put on them and then put out for the world to muddy the waters. As I said, this is generally what we do. Now, when you can see how this works, you can see why it was so necessary for them to construct a conspiracy culture. And how it was so easy to construct a conspiracy culture around the real conspiracy that does exist. And the real conspiracy is one that I think everybody knows, and that is the fact that we are very, very much under control. What's going on here essentially is a system of people farming. It's just figuring out who the farmer is and where the borders, the fence line to the farm is, so we can all escape, if such a thing is even possible. You know, whether this is even just some type of recycling situation where our souls and our consciousness gets recycled all the time. And I would suggest that's a distinct possibility as well. You know, even when you look at this reality, it's like a collective projection of reality. When you start looking at things such as the holographic universe, start looking at things such as the electrical universe, you realize just how much we can affect reality by our thoughts and by our belief systems and by what we perceive the truth to be. Well, we could turn this reality into anything that we want. It just depends on what we believe is possible. So then you start looking at that as well. You start to question why our beliefs are being manipulated the way they are and what's really going on here. How much of this prison that we're living in have we constructed for ourselves simply by our belief that the prison is real? You know, and that's an interesting area to get into when you start bringing consciousness into the equation. You start thinking about how much of this we are creating ourselves. Start remembering stories of the fairies in the garden when you're a child and the things you used to see when you were a child. Things that you can't see now, but you're sure existed when you were a little child. The stories from Castaneda, Don Juan, when he talks about the fleeting shadows that the children used to see in the garden, but by the time they become adults, they've convinced themselves that they can't see these things anymore. Imagine what would exist outside visible light that we could possibly see if we were simply able to believe that we could see outside visible light. You know, how much of what we cannot see and what we cannot perceive is based on what we perceive reality to be, based on our belief of what is possible within the parameters of what we call reality. Because very often what we perceive reality to be is based on our scientific interpretation of reality, not on our spiritual or emotional or etheric interpretation of reality. And people may say, well, what is an etheric interpretation of reality? Now you're being too esoteric and too airy-fairy and I don't understand what you mean. Well, you know, like I said, if we were to have our belief system interfered in such a way, I mean, the stories that you hear of the Incas or the Aztecs, apparently, I don't know whether it's true, but you hear stories of the Aztecs weren't able to see the Spanish ships because they didn't believe that the ships were real, and so they couldn't see them. Now, how much of that is going on in the world around us as well? Now, when I've drank ayahuasca, I mean, I haven't drank for a long time, 6 or nearly 7 years since I've drank ayahuasca now, but I remember when I drank, some of the things that I saw, these were entities that existed outside visible light. These were not hallucinations. These were different aspects of reality that I could access because my pineal had opened up. That's what it felt like, you know. The fact that our pineal is closed and we are not able to perceive so much of reality, how much of it affects reality? How much of reality around us is being destroyed simply because we're not aware that it is there? It's like Plato's allegory of the cave. If you were just seeing shadows on the wall, you wouldn't really know what these shadows are doing. These shadows could be hacking the earth to pieces. They could be killing each other. You wouldn't know they're simply shadows playing out on the wall. And you're not aware of what is going on because you are not aware that there's anything other than the wall. You know, how much of reality is being destroyed around us because we simply cannot see that which is around us. We cannot see that which is there due to our belief that such things do not exist because of what we've been taught. It's an interesting question. These are all very, very interesting questions. And even when I look at the civilizations that came previously to us, you look at the concept of giants. And the giants are real. I mean, there were so many giants on the earth. They found skeletons of giants, and we still find remnants of giants in certain cultures that were around as recently as 150 years ago, 100 years ago, 50 years ago. There were still giant people around. Well, we were considered to be giants anyway. These were sort of seen as throwbacks and freaks of nature, but what if they're not? What if they were remnants of the culture that was here before? You look at a lot of these old buildings, they have extremely large doors. You look at some of the temples and some of the pyramids, they've got these incredibly large staircases, way too uncomfortable for people our size to be able to walk up these staircases. But if we were giants, we'd find it quite easily. And some of them would even have been difficult for the giants. So the question must be asked, how tall were the people that were before those giants? Are we facing a situation whereby the size of humanity gets reduced with every so-called reset or plasma event or whatever it is that causes these events to happen? You know, even when you start looking at some of the things such as the guy on the Mud Fossil University channel, I mean, that stuff, some of it must be right out there for so many people. But when you look at that, you look at the sheer size of some of the old stone giants that seem to be petrified around the place, and some of the old stone animals that we see, these are absolutely huge. Some of these remains, well, alleged remains anyway, you've got to question. Did we start off as something quite huge, and do we get gradually reduced in size as, I don't know, the atmosphere becomes more dense, the gravity becomes more dense, or whatever you want to call gravity, I mean, whatever it is, the magnetism becomes more dense, the consciousness gets further and further locked down, the intellect gets further and further impaired, and we lose connection with all around us because of simply what we believe is true and what we believe is possible. Pretty out there to think about, but it's just something to consider. You know, as I mentioned once before, if you were aware of these things and you wanted to impair the human race, would it not be beneficial to construct somewhere like Hollywood, whereby you are going to attract all of the most intelligent and creative people on earth into an area that is known to be prone to cataclysms and have this intelligentsia wiped out each time? You know, so you lower the human intellect each cycle. You further lower the human intellect. And when you look at the maps that we see whereby California looks like it was once a peninsula and then it was an island and then it was a peninsula again, we got some cataclysms that seem to have happened there, at least two major cataclysms that have happened there just since the 1600s. This seems to be quite interesting that that would be a place that you would set up somewhere like Hollywood. You look at the concept of further reducing the knowledge by constructing languages that would be very, very difficult to interpret for later generations, such as English. I've gone through English before. The amount of weird spellings in English, you know, O-U-G-H for cough, O, do, enough, all of these weird rules of English, silent letters and words spelt completely convolutedly, you know, nothing to do with phonetics. Very, very difficult language for people to understand. If we're writing down all of the tales of this modern world in English and we're expecting races that come after us to be able to interpret these writings, well, we're really going to be pushing heavy loads uphill, folks, because it's very doubtful that anyone's going to be able to figure out the grammatic rules of English because they're just so convoluted. It's very difficult for people, even in the modern world, to learn how to speak English, you know, someone from another language to learn how to speak and interpret English because it's just such a convoluted language. So is there a reason for that? Is that what the Shakespearean Revolution was about constructing a language which is more and more removed from anything natural, more and more removed from the sort of languages we should be speaking? As I've also mentioned to you, Magyar, Hungarian, there are 48 letters in this alphabet. In these languages, you can express every nuance of human emotion, things that you simply can't do in English. So there's that side of it as well. There's a lot of things that point to the fact that we are being systematically dumbed down and systematically lowered in our biology and our intellect and our spirituality, like lowered in all respects of what it means to be human, and that this is happening in reoccurring cycles that are quite predictable. And if history and the remnants and artifacts and even sunspot activity and all this stuff is to be taken and assessed and correlated and put together, it would appear that these events happen possibly as quickly and regularly as every 200 years. And if that's the case, then we are pretty well due for another one of these events almost any day, certainly by the year 2040 or 2050. And that's certainly something interesting to think about. You know, it makes a lot of sense. It makes sense why there are so many wars, why there is all of this political theater, why there is so much stuff there to distract us. So many paths of activism we can take, none of which lead to any type of self-reflection at all. You know, it would appear that self-reflection and giving mankind time to actually think about reality is one of the furthest things from the agenda, folks. I mean, they just don't want you thinking about any of this stuff, and they don't want you ever discovering the power that you have. But what if all this is a conscious projection? What if reality could be anything you want it to be, anything you believe it can be? Wouldn't that be a great reason to construct the flat earth belief system, folks? Think about that one. The flat earthers are promoting the concept that the earth is a disc with a sealed dome on top and we can't get out. What a great way to construct a prison for the mind of man, to have enough people adopt this belief system for it to become a reality. Imagine if it was that simple. And imagine if everybody could simply believe that the world is free and far different to what they've been told, and it would simply change into being that. Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing? Of course, it's a collective projection, though, so the question is, to create any type of reality, how many people do you need to believe in that reality before it becomes a reality? It's another question. I find this sort of stuff to be fascinating, though. I mean, it's all very esoteric, all very speculative, and, you know, it's not anything you can prove unless you could somehow get enough people to come on board and simply try it out as an experiment, and you got to wonder when that's going to happen. But what if, folks? What if all of this stuff is put into our minds simply because this is what creates the reality around us? You know, the externalization of the hierarchy. It's just an interesting concept. It's something interesting to think of, and the more you do ceremony, and the more you consider some of the teachings that have been left behind for us, the more it does actually become a distinct possibility. You know, reality is an interesting thing. And when you consider reality to be electrical, everything to be electrical, even matter to have its basis in electricity, you think of us as being electrical beings. Every thought that leaves your head is an electrical impulse. How does it all fit together? What does it all mean? And how much are we participating in the creation of this prison ourselves simply by believing the prison is real? You know, by believing that the rulers have power over us is certainly what gives them power over us. But how much of that applies to reality itself? How much of it applies to physical matter? How much of it applies to the existence that we are creating for ourselves? Because there is a real possibility that that's where it all comes from. You know, even if you think of the concept of the mind of God and us simply being a projection of the mind of God broken into 7 billion different pieces in order to be able to experience itself. Well, how much of this comes from what we are creating? It's an interesting question. It's an interesting thing to think about, and that's one of the reasons why I don't have any stake in the outcome of any of this stuff, folks. I simply look at it, I call it for what it is, I call it for the way I see it, and I attempt to offer some sort of solution for people to help them understand that we could change this whole world with a little bit of inner reflection, folks. You know, you change your perspective and you change the way you interact with the world, and the world has no choice but to change around you. That's something that I've found out over my life anyway. I've been able to change my life completely by changing my perspective, and I haven't actually had to do anything because It's all an emotional mirror. That's just how the world works. Well, folks, we have now reached that time of the day once more where we have got to the end of the show. It's been a pleasure to come and talk to you today, probably a little bit scattered and all over the place, but, well, it's just the way it goes. These random thought flows just seem to go anywhere. But thank you for joining me anyway. As I've mentioned to you previously, I'm going to be speaking in Philadelphia next week, or actually the week after, on the 13th, 14th, and 15th of September. I'm going to be in Philadelphia speaking at Anarchadelphia, the anarchist conference in Philadelphia. I'm not going to be putting out a show that weekend. I'll be putting out one next weekend, but then I'm going to be not putting out a show the weekend of the 13th, 14th, and 15th simply because I'll be at a conference. It's going to be a little intermittent with shows between now and the end of October, folks, because I'm going to be traveling until October 22nd, and I've got a few speaking dates to do, so it's just going to depend on where I am, what the accommodation is that I'm staying in, and whether I've actually got space to do a radio show, whether I've even got an internet connection to do a radio show. And so you'll just have to bear with me until the end of October, but I'll get as much out to you as I can. There may be some interviews that get posted along the way as well. I suppose it won't really matter at the moment until my YouTube channel gets reinstated anyway, so we'll just see how that goes. But as I said, folks, on the 13th, 14th, and 15th, I'll be speaking at Anarchadelphia in Philadelphia. On the 27th of September, I will be speaking at an event called Avatars of the Earth Gathering. This is at Mount Shasta in Northern California. There is a good chance I'll be speaking at an event in Denver as well, around about October 13th as well, but I'll keep you posted on that one, and then I'll be back in Australia near the end of October, around about October 22nd, I should be getting back in Australia, so I'll be back to regular radio shows then. Hopefully my YouTube channel will be reinstated by then as well. I've been told, if I look at the channel, it says the strike will be removed on November the 27th, so I'm hoping it's only 2 weeks penalty, and I'll be able to upload YouTube clips to that channel in 2 weeks the way it happened last time when I got a strike against me. I said it was for 3 months, but after 2 weeks I was able to upload again, so I'm kind of hoping that's the way it goes. But if it continues, folks, I'm just going to move over to BitChute. The only reason I stay on YouTube now is because I've got so many subscribers, and it does get out to more people. It just does. I mean, if you post on YouTube, you reach more people. Even the people that subscribe to my channel, I've suggested they go over to BitChute. I still find that the BitChute clips just don't get as many views as the YouTube clips because people are simply used to YouTube. So that's the way it goes, folks. But the BitChute channel is there, the Crow House on BitChute. The YouTube channel is linked up to that channel. And any video that is ever deleted from YouTube, you will still find on the BitChute channel. And if you use a VPN, you'll find that you're able to access BitChute in most countries. So that it really is the way to go if you want to continue watching the show, continue listening to the show. I mean, you can get the MP3s from the website as long as they continue to allow the website to stay there. And you'll get them on BitChute as well. There are people that are posting the shows on Spotify and on SoundCloud, and I believe podcasts are still being made of the show as well. There may be people that are still having difficulty downloading the podcast. If that's the case, then you will find the shows on Spotify, and you'll find the shows on SoundCloud as well. If you just search Max Egan or The Crow House on any of those two platforms, you should find the MP3s of the show, or some form of show anyway. And failing that, as I said, you can go to my website, thecrowhouse.com, go to the radio archives, and where you see the link to podcast for any particular show, you can just right-click that link and download the show as an MP3, and that will play on any MP3 device. As always, I'd like to thank the many people who send me so many kind emails. I have actually gotten to a lot of emails, so it's good to be getting through some of those and actually replying to people. And thank you to those who have responded to my replies already as well. I appreciate that. Thank you to the people who continue to support me on Patreon. You are the only people who keep your show on the air, so I cannot thank you enough for that. And thank you to all those who continue to share the words to others, because really that's what it's all about, folks, waking up the sleeping masses to the fact that we actually don't have to do this. That would be a great thing. And if we did that, well, we could change the world pretty quickly. And I think you'd be surprised, folks, how many people are waking up. I think this alleged suicide by Jeffrey Epstein has gone a long way to waking people up. The video of the police, the Philadelphia police, spraying fake blood onto themselves and then running back into the fray seems to have been a great thing to get out to people as well. I know a lot of people that have seen that are starting to question the official narrative a lot more, and that's a good thing. But that's it for me, folks. We've completely run out of time, so I'll leave it there for now. Thank you for joining on the show today, and I'll look forward to speaking to you again next week. Please take very good care until then. In luck, Cash.